my heart breaks when I look at the Middle East and I see that there's still so much bloodshed that's going on and so much wanton destruction and poverty and a real lack of political expression and opportunity for so many people.
Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another. Welcome. Joining me today is John Brennan, former director of the CIA under President Obama, former assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, also for President Obama, and nearly 30-year veteran of the CIA, where he focused on the Middle East as well as South Asia. He is currently a Distinguished Fellow for Global Security at the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, the host organization for this podcast, and a National Security Analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, and most recently, an author. He has just finished a memoir, which will be forthcoming later this year. Hi, John.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for the invitation.
Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast. I wanted to start by going back in time a bit. And I'm sure we're going to learn about this when we read your book, but I wanted to start where you and I are both associated, which is Fordham University. You went there as an undergraduate. You graduated with a BA in political science. And my question to you is, why did you choose political science as a college student?
Well, when I entered Fordham, and I was a commuter student going back and forth to the Bronx from northern New Jersey, I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to become involved somehow in international affairs because my cousin, who had served in the Peace Corps and was with AID overseas, had filled my head with all of these wonderful stories about life overseas. And so I wanted to explore the world. And when I was searching around for a major, I thought political science sounded most appropriate for doing something that would allow me to travel the globe.
So then when you were an undergraduate, you went to the American University in Cairo?
Yes. Well, in fact, in the summer of my freshman year at Fordham, I went to Indonesia and spent about 2 months over there doing a tutorial on oil and politics in Indonesia. Because my cousin was the AID officer of the embassy in Jakarta at the time. And so I got to travel across Java, went to Bali, met with Indonesian government officials. And so it really spurred my interest in traveling overseas. So then in my sophomore year, my political science professor at Fordham brought in a brochure for the American University in Cairo, and I put in my application and was accepted and went to Cairo then, which got me interested in the Middle East, started my language training in Arabic, and just spurred my interest in a wonderful part of the world that unfortunately has been beset by so much violence and political differences.
I'm still curious, why the Middle East and why Arabic? Was it something about the culture that appealed to you? I mean, what was it? Do you know?
Well, in sophomore year, I was taking a course on Middle East politics with Professor Tillis, and I became very intrigued with that part of the world. And Professor Tillis taught with such a passion and with knowledge that really it just spurred my interest in learning more about that part of the world. And there was a lot going on at the time in the Middle East in 75, you know, a couple of years after the 73 war. And so when he came in with that brochure, I opted for it. Now, if he came in with a brochure for American University, you know, in Taiwan or something else, I might have opted for that too, because being a commuter student going back and forth in northern New Jersey, spending an hour and a half on buses and trains going up to Fordham, you know, was getting kind of old. And so I wanted to do something differently, and I wanted to live away at school. So that was my opportunity to do it. And once I was in Cairo, I just fell in love with the people, the culture, the history, the language, the region as a whole. And so that spurred my lifelong interest in the Middle East.
So it was a twist of fate, basically.
Life is just a series of twists of fate.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's actually right. So I'm curious, you know, you described the Middle East as, you know, an interesting and challenging time in the Middle East then, but look at it now. I mean, I look at the Middle East now and it's hard to say where almost any of the countries are headed. So my question to you, and this is a big question, is in stepping back from the Middle East and looking at all these decades since you were there as a student up until now, do you think we're in a period of unusual instability in the Middle East? We see this periodically in the Middle East. How would you describe it comparatively where we are now?
I would say we always see this in the Middle East. Ever since World War II, and certainly, you know, long before that, there has just been a series of problems that have been brought on by colonialism, that have been brought on by religious extremism, that have been brought on by corrupt governments, regimes, authoritarian rulers, subjugation of peoples. And unfortunately, the history of the Arab world is a tragic one in many respects, because it is such a beautiful part of the world with such a rich history. This is where, you know, the cradle of civilization. But if we look back over the last, you know, number of decades, there have been a series of coups and wars and, again, corrupt regimes that really have taken advantage, I think, of, you know, coming into power. And usually it's designed to subjugate opposing tribes or parties or ethnic groups or religious faiths. So there's still a lot of nation building that needs to go on. It needs to go on from inside of these countries. I think a lot of people had hoped that the Arab Spring was going to give birth to that democratic processes that would take root. But I think the experience has been that it's very difficult to flip a light switch on democracy. It really takes quite a bit of time. And unfortunately, I've seen, you know, one step forward, two steps back in a number of these countries. Whether you're talking about places like Syria or Egypt or Yemen or Libya or Algeria, you name it, there is just a very tragic record of, you know, some false starts when it comes to democratic initiatives. And it usually comes down to people who come into power doing everything they can to retain that power at the expense of democratic principles.
Is there any country in the Middle East that you think has a better chance of surviving and reaching stability and viability in terms of peace and economic strength as opposed to others? Anything that could be a blueprint for other societies if things went the right way?
Well, they all have their own sort of unique histories and unique challenges and problems. I think Tunisia probably has had the most success emerging from the turmoil of the Arab Spring. Tunisia has its own sort of unique history in terms of the influence of Europe and France, having some established political parties and press. You know, I'd always hoped that Algeria was going to be able to shake off its authoritarian past. You know, Jordan, although a monarchy, I think there are democratic structures and institutions there that I think have allowed that small kingdom to survive in a very turbulent part of the world. And so it's hard to point to a country in the Arab world that really is moving down that path of democracy. Because I do think it's going to be a decades long challenge. And it has to be, I think, more comprehensive than just having, you know, voting for president. You need to reform a lot of the systems, especially the economies. I had great hopes that when al-Sisi became president in Egypt, that he was going to take lessons from Egypt's past and to move Egypt along a economic and political reform path. But unfortunately, I think he has opted for the same types of authoritarian practices that his predecessors have used. So my heart breaks when I look at the Middle East and I see that there's still so much bloodshed that's going on and so much wanton destruction and poverty and a real lack of political expression and opportunity for so many people.
And what about the rest of the world? For those of us who read the newspaper beyond our own politics every day, and for anybody who reads the morning brief in the morning, there's just turmoil all over the world right now, whether it's South Korea and North Korea, whether it's Latin America, whether it's Africa. So I want to repeat that question for the world at large. Is it a moment of unusual strife, tension, and instability, or is it really just that we get more and more information every day than we used to get?
I believe that governance in the 21st century is much more difficult than it ever has been in the past because of some of the things that you point out. Globalization really has made this world much more interconnected, much more fast-paced. The technological advancements that have occurred really have transformed our lives. And for government officials to be able to orchestrate the instruments of government in a manner that addresses the needs of diverse populations, it's really quite challenging. And especially in democratic systems where you have sort of constant reviews of government performance and elections, and sometimes it's difficult to have continuity of effort. And too often, leaders in the Western democracies are focusing on their re-election prospects as opposed to what's in the best interest of society. So I do think that for many years, I think the United States tried to be the exemplar of how democratic principles can be realized in governing and try to set an example for the rest of the world. Unfortunately, I think under the Trump regime, that example has not been there. And now we don't have to worry only about the authoritarian rulers in places like China and Russia. We also have to worry about individuals who get to the top of the government through some democratic processes, but then act like autocrats and authoritarian leaders once they get there, suppressing freedom of speech, delegitimizing the media, and using the government institutions, whether it be intelligence, law enforcement, or whatever, to perpetuate their rule. And I think that sends a very bad signal to countries around the world. If we have this type of what I would refer to as political corruption here in the United States as the example, there's really less incentive, I would say, for governments around the world to really adhere to democratic principles, because if they don't, they're not going to be held to account by the United States, which traditionally was the ones that would do that.
I want to follow that a little bit. Do you think we need a rethink about some of the laws and even constitutional principles that the country has normally gone by? Because no matter what's happening now inside the executive, particularly inside the Department of Justice, inside the White House, there is a sense that pushback is almost impossible, that really getting into a dialogue in which there can be some forward vision that unifies partisan voices is no longer possible. So do you think we need a reconsideration, or is it just this is a moment in time, we'll get beyond it, and then we'll just adhere in the way we have in the past to what's guided us before?
Well, I think there needs to be a closer look at what we need to do in order to ensure that democratic principles and values are able to prevail in this environment. And the thing that I'm very concerned about are several things. One is that there is a total absence among some in terms of being honest. And the ability to deceive masses using demagogic rhetoric, I think, is just too widespread. And so you have, you know, these highly partisan politicians who will just misrepresent the facts and the truth, as well as the solutions to a lot of these very challenging problems, by, again, mischaracterizing reality. And unfortunately, the masses, many of them, will buy into that. So I believe very strongly that people should have the absolute right to select their leaders, which is the foundation of democracies. At the same time, though, I am concerned that there's no requirements, basically, except maybe age and being a native-born citizen in the United States, that anybody can sort of run for office. And voters have very little ability to really discern truth from falsehoods in terms of what these candidates say about themselves and what they say about reality. And maybe there needs to be some more objective credentialing or objective evaluations of the claims and the records of these individuals. Because it's clear that Mr. Trump's ability to get to the White House was a result of his, in many respects, masterful ability to mislead, I think, the American people. And there's something, I think, that is very antithetical to democracy in that.
We're going to get to talking about the election a little later. First, I want to just redirect the conversation and talk a little bit about governance after 9/11. There was a massive reorganization in a variety of ways in the executive after the attacks of 9/11. And that involved setting up the Department of Homeland Security, setting up the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, changing a number of departments, including the Department of Justice, to have a National Security Division. Ultimately, do you think that these changes were successful in addressing the question that inspired them, was how can we make sure another attack doesn't happen? How can we make sure that we're safe from terrorism and or other threats to the nation? Do you think it was an effective reorganization? And a follow-on question to that is, do you think that we still need these organizations intact, or do you think their mission can grow to include threats they might not have included in the past?
Well, couple points. One is that I think many of those changes were certainly necessary. Having served as the chief of staff to the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, when the entire intelligence community and the CIA were run by the same individual, and then having been director of CIA, I can attest to the fact that running the community and running CIA are two full-time jobs. So I think separating out those responsibilities was important. And then the Director of National Intelligence, who now is, you know, the leader of the intelligence community, sits atop an office that, you know, has grown in size, and it includes a lot of components such as the National Counterterrorism Center. So I think 16 or so years after that statute was signed into law, I think it is worthwhile to take a fresh look at that, because any changes that take place in government, I think they're changes that may have been necessary and worthwhile at the time, but that doesn't mean that they're etched in stone. I think for any institution, whether it be government or, you know, the private sector, stasis in such a dynamic world is a recipe for disaster. And so I think there needs to be almost constant review, evaluation, and adaptability to the challenges of the day. And also, it's worthwhile, I think, to take a look at what worked well, what didn't work as well, what might need to be tweaked or changed. One of the reasons when I was at the CIA, I initiated an overhaul of the agency because its structure was basically the same over the previous 70 years. And so I thought there would need to be a much more integrated approach. That doesn't mean that that approach is going to work in 2050. The thing is to try to ensure that organizational structures or community structures are going to be malleable enough so that they can be adjusted or tweaked without wholesale restructuring or wholesale, change. So, again, I think many of those changes at 9/11 were important. It broke down a lot of the barriers that existed between law enforcement and intelligence, very necessary for better information sharing. But now I think we've had 15 years of practice to see just how well this works in reality. And so it might be time to take a fresh, objective, nonpartisan, apolitical look at this and to see what type of restructuring needs to be done.
When it comes to COVID, do you think that there will end up being a new structure set up, maybe not as massive as Department of Homeland Security, but a new structure that integrates cross-agency and cross-expertises and concerns? What's happened? Or do you think there can be a repurposing of things that we already have?
Well, I think, unfortunately, too many folks, you know, have the mindset that, well, if you just put more money to something, or if you just restructure something, or if you just put, you know, new people at the top, things are going to magically change. Although I'm a very proud liberal arts guy from Fordham, I've become really enamored with systems engineering. And to try to understand all of the features and facets of the ecosystem that are required to address problems. And so for COVID, there is a large ecosystem that is needed to be leveraged optimally in order to address these types of challenges. It's practices, it's processes, it's coordination, it's collaboration, it's making sure that you have the system in place that is going to be able to quickly react to what is a very, you know, challenging problem that, you know, appears very quickly. And so I do think that there needs to be some systemic changes. And it doesn't mean setting up a new department. It doesn't mean, changing, a particular structure in, health and human services, whatever. It's taking a look at the U.S. government writ large, and the departments and agencies there. But it's not just the government, the federal government, because I think, as we've seen, this whole of nation challenge requires the federal government to work with state and local governments, work with the private sector, to work with the not-for-profit sector. And that's what has made governance in the 21st century so challenging. You have so many actors that need to play a role. A lot of the challenges we face today are well beyond the ability of a government or governments to address. And that's why systems engineering or systems integration, how are you going to leverage the capabilities, the knowledge, the resources that exist across these different realms in an optimal fashion? And it made my head hurt when I was at the White House and I had to deal with, a lot of these issues when I was President Obama's Homeland Security Advisor, dealing with cyber, dealing with the H1N1 challenge back in 2009, because you recognize that there are so many different players and how do you get them to work collaboratively together and, row in the same direction? It's really, really tough.
You know, one of the things that you're really talking about is the lack of expertise within various structures of government right now, the absence of a pandemic office that could respond to this in time. If we're really talking about rethinking how to structure government, its relationship to the private sector, its relationship to the federal government, to the states, I come back to my other point, which is, do we really need a timeout to really rethink things? And if we don't get that, it's kind of like a Band-Aid approach. We'll take care of this, then we'll take care of that, then we'll hope it all works together. Do you actually think it's possible to both continue on as we are and to restructure, rethink, reformulate, and get ready for whatever's coming, whether it's something from climate change, something from a foreign threat, something from pandemic? Is that possible?
Well, I guess most people believe that politics is a necessary evil. But I am most disenchanted with what I see coming out of partisans in Congress who, put partisan loyalty above national interests. And many of them on both sides of the aisle but I think it's made worse recently by Mr. Trump's antics, really put their re-election prospects at the forefront in terms of what it is that they do, in terms of looking for funding or looking for whatever. And I find this craven approach to governance really to be quite undermining of what it is we need to do as a country. And unfortunately, we have become so fractured as a country and, you know, become polarized that as long as we continue to be at one another's throats here, and that the, you know, Congress and many of the political environments are just dysfunctional, I find it very difficult to see how we're going to tackle these very, very demanding and daunting challenges effectively. So I do think that there is a need for a rethinking. But you know, when I look at some of the things that I think are counterproductive to good governance, such as political gerrymandering, campaign finance laws, other things that seem to perpetuate a lot of these problems, it's going to be very hard to make the progress that we need to make unless there is a more objective, nonpartisan effort to try to really allow the government, the U.S. government, the federal government, to really work on behalf of the people as a whole. So, you know, lately I've been very disenchanted with, again, the political waters that are swirling in Washington. You know, I think there are some hopes of, or rays of sunlight, some people who really are trying to go beyond their party affiliation and really look at some of the issues that are really challenging for the next generations of Americans. But unfortunately, I think too many politicians are in the here and now and the me, and they're just they're ignoring the longer and more strategic issues that really need to be addressed.
Well, there is a new generation of politicians that are either entered Congress or are trying to enter Congress with some very concrete ideas about how to rethink how government takes care of its people. Just for starters, not even getting into the national security conversation, which brings me to the question of the elections that are coming up. They seem to me challenged in so many different ways, whether it's because of COVID. You saw the people standing in line in Georgia for hours in the rain with their babies attached to them. You know, what are we asking our citizens to do for this next election? And then there's the whole issue of interference by foreign powers. So I want to ask you, how well, and I know you don't have access to information other than what we know, but how can we tell the American people that it's okay to vote in this election, that their vote's going to be counted? Can we say that with any assurance?
Well, I think it's absolutely critical for every American who can vote to vote. And I know there are going to be challenges. There probably going to be long lines. There are going to be machines that break down. There are going to be efforts, unfortunately, to prevent some people from voting, try to suppress votes in certain areas as a way to increase the prospects of one party or the other to prevail. I think there also is going to be a lot of, you know, things that are going to be swirling about in social media that some are going to come from foreign sources, some are going to come from domestic sources, that are going to be fabricating and misrepresenting the facts. And that's why I do think it's incumbent on all Americans to try to weed through all of that stuff and not just go to sources of information that reinforce their own views and prejudices, but try to get as honest an appraisal as possible about candidates and about the issues. I am concerned about attempts prior to the election to make the election day voting processes more difficult for voters who hold views other than what those who are in charge of the voting infrastructure in a state or in a local community might agree with. And this, I think, is a real danger to our democracy and our republic, that trying to prevent people from expressing their views on election day, especially in a presidential election. So, but I think the pressure needs to not just continue, but be increased before election, you know, demanding that the voting machines are going to be the best they can be, they're going to be made widely available, that absentee ballots are going to be available, write-ins, so that every opportunity for Americans to vote will be realized. But also taking steps to prevent any type of abuse or misuse of those voting systems. And I do think that progress has been made in areas over the last several years to try to guard against this, you know, foreign interference, especially in the voter registration rolls and tabulation of votes, in terms of the, you know, technical impediments to doing something like that. But I am concerned about the social media environment and how that's going to warp perspectives and votes.
Is this idea or the threat of foreign interference in our elections something we're going to live with forever? Do you think it's just a new part of what it means to be what you call in the challenges of governments in the 21st century? Or is there a way to actually rest assured that our elections are impervious to foreign interference?
Well, I think it will be easier, although maybe not necessarily easy, to make the technical systems of voting, as well as the process of voting, much less vulnerable to foreign interference by taking the measures and trying to, you know, prevent any type of interference in the act of voting. I think there are some very tangible and practical things that can be done there. What is much more challenging is trying to prevent the influence operations that are going to be taking place by foreign governments, by domestic troublemakers, by others that are going to pollute the public square with misinformation and disinformation that will shape the perspectives and then the votes of American citizens. So I think it's a dual challenge. One is trying to ensure that every American who can vote votes, and votes in a manner that their vote is going to be tabulated correctly without any type of interference. The companion challenge, though, is that before they vote, that information overload that comes in is, I think, going to be permeated by a lot of nonsense and a lot of disinformation. And some of it is going to come from our foreign adversaries, and some of it is going to come from various groups with their own political or economic or, you know, ideological agendas. That is a much more difficult challenge, because it really, you know, it gets to the issue of, you know, freedom of speech and the fact that this country is founded upon those freedoms and liberties that we prize, but yet these actors are taking advantage of those freedoms and liberties to misinform the American public.
It would be additionally important to survive this attack, both from within and from without, on our democracy. Do you think we will?
I think it's going to be an iterative process. And I think looking out over the next several decades, I think we will be making some progress. But what it really is going to take is individuals at the top of our government, in the executive branch and legislative branch and judicial branch, who are really going to do what is right as opposed to what is politically expedient or what is personally advantageous. And I very much hope that, you know, all of our future presidents are going to see themselves as presidents of all Americans and almost divorce themselves from any type of political base that, you know, might be forcing them down certain roads that are counterproductive to our national interests. I think that was the concept behind having a president who can lead this country in a manner that represents the interests of the majority and the minority, interests of this country. And unfortunately, I think we've seen a real bastardization of that in this current administration.
Here we are in this new era on the eve of an election. If you were a college student now and you had to pick a part of the world that was going to define the rest of your life, where do you think you would pick now?
Well, there's a lot of work to be done here in the United States. But if somebody who's interested in U.S. foreign policy and America's role in the world, I think Africa is a very sort of undeveloped area, not in terms of the continent, but in terms of research, and the potential in Africa, I think, is enormous. Potential in terms of resources, in terms of commerce, in terms of trade, in terms of political development as well, and economic development, because a lot of these systems are still birthing, even though they've had turbulent histories over the past several decades. I think there's still time to do some things that are going to try to make some of these governments models for others in the future. And unfortunately, the United States, I think, has been stepping back from some of those previous roles. And unfortunately, the Chinese that recognize that it really needs to be long-term investments in a lot of these countries and cultivation of political leaders and political parties, I think they are stepping into the breach in a number of these areas. And I think we're going to pay dearly for that in years to come, because the model that the Chinese are putting forward is not a democratic model. It's an authoritarian model. And unfortunately, I think too many countries and politicians and government officials are looking at the Chinese government model right now, an authoritarian system that doesn't have to worry about, running for re-election every, 2 or 4 years. They're looking at that as maybe the better model to allow continuity of effort. And they look at some of these Western countries, including the United States, and just seeing how messy democracy is. And I think the wrong lessons are being taken away from the recent developments.
One question within that framework, which is, we talk in terms of nation states and continents and areas, but the displaced persons population, both internal displacements and refugees, people seeking asylum all over the world. I saw the numbers last night that somebody read me. They continue to go up exponentially. How does that affect our ability to think about our diplomacy, to know who to be diplomatic with? Do you see it as a game changer, or do you see it just as something else that will come within the purview of discussions among states?
It's a potential game changer, and I think it's something that requires immediate attention. When I was in the Obama administration, we had to deal with a lot of displaced individuals, whether you're talking about from Syria or Iraq or Yemen or Somalia or Libya or you name it. And when I think about the migration of peoples from Africa across the Mediterranean into Europe, that was what really spurred a lot of this reactionary movements, populist movements, nativist movements in Europe. And you can't build a fence high enough, you can't build walls strong enough to keep people out if they're really desperate for their lives and the lives of their families. That's why I do think, when I think about a continent like Africa or countries in the Middle East, there really needs to be a international effort to invest in opportunities in those countries to give those individuals reasons to stay and make a life for themselves and their families in their countries. That's where they are born and raised. And, they leave not because they hate their country, because there's just no opportunity there. And if there's greater foreign investment, if there's greater international collaboration to build up, again, commercial, business, trade, other types of opportunities, I think you'll see more people inclined to stay. You'll also be able to see the ability of these countries and these governments to be able to exploit in a good way the resource and capabilities that they have. That's why I think, you know, Yemen, that I traveled to about a dozen times when I was in the Obama administration, you know, beautiful country, beautiful people. I think it needs to go into some type of international receivership. So, because it's not going to be able to get out of its problems on its own. And it has, what, 25, 28 million people, you know, many of them impoverished. It's just going to continue to fester as a problem unless there really is some effort to try to invest in these countries, again, to try to give them an opportunity to recover. That doesn't mean that the United States goes in and does nation building. No, but it means that we work with other countries around the globe, the ones that have the ability and resources, to try to focus on those challenges. Because, and when I was involved in counterterrorism for so many years, you know, we too often would focus downstream when the terrorists are already, you know, terrorists, and we try to stop them from carrying out attacks. We need to go upstream. We need to go up to the factors and conditions that really give birth to a lot of these terrorist and extremist organizations. And by providing, you know, opportunities for young Yemenis or young Somalis or young Syrians or Iraqis, viable alternatives to extremism, I think that's when we're going to make some progress that will have, I think, long-term positive impact.
So my last question to all people who come on the podcast, as to almost everybody who comes to the center to give a talk, is tell us something hopeful in any area you want to address.
Well, when I was at Fordham and I was just starting off in my life's journey as well as my professional career, my favorite classes were my philosophy classes, where individuals more than 2,000 years ago were really asking some very basic questions about life. You know, although my faith over the years has, I think, fallen by the wayside, but my belief in the ability for man's goodness to prevail over evil remains. I do believe that the arc of history, the world's history, is one that is going to have its ups and downs. But when I look at the human condition today compared to 50 years ago, you know, there are fewer people who are dying as a result of war or famine or pestilence. You know, the great advancements in medicine and technology have really allowed people from all across the globe to be able to benefit immeasurably from all of these advancements that are a result of the globalization that I think has very positive dimensions to it. It's uneven, but I think the trajectory is positive. So I think right now the chapter of U.S. history is a sad one and a challenging one. But I do think that arc of U.S. history is going to be on the incline. And hopefully we're going to learn from some of the mistakes that have been made and the lessons that we've learned. And I do think that, you know, we will like to think to have a vaccine for COVID. I think also that this might spur some, you know, more thinking about how better to prepare for future pandemics or challenges. And again, I think that overall, we need to keep sight of that longer arc of history and remember that we are not just a resilient country, but I think a resilient globe if we choose to be. And if we, again, think about some of the longer term issues that are going to affect our children and grandchildren, you know, whether it be climate change or cyber issues or the challenges of, you know, democratization. And I like to think that there are a lot of people out there whose voices find expression that will resonate, I think, more as we come to grips with a lot of these problems. So although, you know, sometimes if anybody has seen any of my tweets, sometimes I focus or harp on some of the negatives that are out there. It's because I feel so strongly about the obligations of those in government to live up to the trust placed in them by the American people. And I do think that overall and over time that we will be able to find our way in a manner that allows us to better address all of these what seem to be very daunting challenges as we go forward.
Well, that is hopeful, but you know, I wanted to point out that you and I graduated college the same year, the same time, and that's a long time ago. And I think
thanks for reminding me, Karen. That's great. Yeah.
Well, I have to remind myself too. So, and I listen to you and I watch my own choices in life. And I just think that we expected a world that would be on the incline, as you say, not the decline, that would turn out to be a world of peace, stability, and goodness. And so I'm glad that, as you talked about twist of fates at the beginning, I'm glad that your fate overlapped with the center's and mine. And so thank you for joining me and thank you for being a fellow at the center.
Well, thank you, Karen. And you were a child prodigy, so you were a lot younger when you graduated college than I was.
That's exactly right.
But I will say, I think our generation and subsequent generations have become much more impatient in terms of wanting positive change, as opposed to, I think, previous generations that since things didn't happen as quickly, I think they recognize that sometimes the struggle takes time. And I don't think it's a bad idea that people are impatient because as we're dealing now with racial injustice in this country, it's, you know, things are long overdue. So I think that pressure needs to be maintained. And I think we should continue to have those expectations because without a doubt, this is an exceptional country with tremendous, tremendous, you know, resource and capabilities and as the melting pot of this world. So we shouldn't settle. We should never settle. We shouldn't settle in terms of our political leadership. We shouldn't settle for the way things are. When we, you know, see wrong, we should try to right it. See war, try to end it. Again, that's why I am hopeful, but I recognize that there are a lot of challenges between now and then, and so I want to continue to, you know, have the clarion call for people to speak up, speak out, and do the right thing.
So we'll have you back in a year so we can talk about, because this is going to be one heck of a year. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interests online forum at centeronnationalsecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.